Radio Free Brooklyn.
Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. Hey, I'm Dr. Lisa. I had a frog in my throat. That never happened to me on the air, first thing like that. That's weird. Anyway, thanks for listening. I'm glad you're here. You're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, the greatest radio station in the world. In the world, actually, because I listened to all of them this weekend, and this is definitely the best. So thanks for tuning in. I want to remind you of how great the station is, and we are a nonprofit. That means if you donate money to us, you can put it on your taxes if you actually make enough money to pay taxes. So go to our radiofreebrooklyn.org /donate page and you know, just empty your bank account. You'll get it back. You'll get it back from the government, I promise. So anyway, I'm really excited. Like, I'm actually like a little nervous, excited, because this is a big get for me. I have Jason Zineman, New York Times comedy critic, on today. So like, for me, I don't know if you guys give a shit, but I do. So this is a big deal to me. So I need you guys to be like, give me your supportive vibes out there so that I get, there's so much I want to talk to him about and I need to get it all in, and I don't know if it's going to, you know, whatever, just send out the good vibes. Okay. Also, today, because Jason Zineman is here, we have a special sponsor, Spam. We are sponsored by Spam. Have you guys tried Spam lately? You know, Spam has 6 different ingredients. Did you know that? And only one of them they call it meat and pork together. That's one of the ingredients. I'm surprised it only had 6. But it's good. It can't be that bad for you. It only has 6 ingredients. You should go to their website. They've got a great shop, museum, and a shop. So go out, get yourself some Spam, and get yourself some Spam swag. Hello, Jason.
Hello. I'm thrilled to be here.
Oh, see? I feel better already.
I love that it's sponsored by Spam. I mean, what could be more perfect?
Yeah, well, that's perfect for you.
Totally.
That's an inside joke, folks. You got to read the book. That's a great inside joke. So read the book. Jason has written, in my mind, the seminal book, and I think a lot of people feel this way, about David Letterman. It's called Letterman, The Last Giant of Late Night. And it was a New York Times bestseller and a 2017 New York Times notable book. Jason is also the first and only, really, comedy writer for the New York Times. They invented the job. They made the job for Jason. And he's been doing it since 2011. And there's a lot I want to get to today. There's so much. This book is really, really great. And there's so much do your own fucking research, okay? Just look it up. I put the link on my page. But what really fascinated me about this book is that mostly that Jason was able to get it written, because the people that he got to talk to are not easy to get to talk to. He said that it was a very difficult, I think he said it was painful. Let me see my notes there. Did you say it was painful?
That's accurate. I mean, it's painful, but it may be painful to finish any book.
Well, and you know, some people, you think it's easy anyway. So that was, but a lot of what I think is so great about that, I'm personally interested in, is the way that Jason breaks down the creative process that Letterman went through, that the show went through, and how much of that is still in our culture today and has funneled through the culture. And one more thing about Jason before I officially introduce him is that Jason is a champion of my favorite kind of comedy, which is the space between, which is the most innovative Jason and I were talking about this. So we agree, I think, if you agree, that it's the most innovative type of creative work going on today. The certain space of comedy that Jason is able to write about that you don't hear about everywhere. And I'm just going to mention a few names of the people. And you can go look them up and you'll know what I'm talking about. Brett Davis, Joe Firestone, Julio Torres, and Tyler Fisher. And recently, Hannah Gadsby, he wrote about, who's an amazing, innovative comedian. And that's where all the new ideas are coming from, folks. So get on that. So, Jason, why don't we start out with just give us like your quick take on the book so that we can get deeper into it.
Sure. So, yeah, I mean, I grew up loving David Letterman, and when I started this comedy beat, I noticed that so many of the people who I would talk to for these major comedians of the day were influenced by Letterman. And so I set out to write this book that in one sense was to try to kind of explain this figure who was really important to me, to kind of explain the comedy scene today because he's had such an impact. And three, to kind of explain to understand myself in a weird way, because he was not just an important comedian and a late night show, but also somebody who had a huge influence on just the way that people talk and act and use, you know, irony and this kind of thing. So the original idea was to focus kind of purely on the work and analyze the work, and then it kind of ballooned into a biography when I realized that you can't really just write a book on the work of a talk show host because their work is so inextricably tied with their life. So it started as a book about kind of Letterman in the 80s, which is when I really started to watch him, or when he was on and when he was doing, you know, I argue sort of his most adventurous work. But then it grew into this, you know, this biography.
Yeah, that's well put. I think that sums it up pretty well, actually. So one of the things, I mean, you know, that's really notable is that you kind of make it two parts, one where he's really, really innovative. And then when it turns into a much more serious talk show where his personality and his, should we call it Machiavellian? I'm going to say Machiavellian hubris. How's that sound?
Wow. I like it. I wouldn't use necessarily.
That's a little over-promise there. You know, it's funny. So you can see how that comes out. But I wanted to get into that because I think it's really, really interesting. And just to give you guys an, you know, like a little bit of a basis of what I'm talking about is I'm really curious about how somebody who seems to have so many self-destructive qualities creatively, I'm not talking about anything else, in their work is able to triumph so hugely. And my frame of reference, I was telling Jason this before you guys got here, is that, you know, I used to be in advertising. And so I have seen so many creative directors who were known in my book as alcoholic womanizers, but still they ruled, like they just wanted to, they did a lot of stuff that wasn't necessarily, like, how did they get away with it? They weren't approving the right things, or they would make things late, or they would, you know, they were always screwing things up. Like, I mean, one time there was an account that I was totally solid on, and the creative director insisted on coming to the meeting, and we lost the account. But that's just one example of millions and millions. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that, and I wanted to find out, like, David Letterman, who disowned his work. He was always very, very angry, or seemed angry and critical. And he was the one who was the face and in charge of everything. But other people were creating work for him, and he was always negative. Do you want to describe that better than me, Jason?
No, that's good. That's good. It makes me think of something. I mean, you were talking about these alcoholic creative directors because, you know, Letterman's father was an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And went to AA, and in fact, Letterman told me about how he you know, when he saw his dad kind of perform in these AA meetings, he got the sense that that was what he was really loved doing, even though he wasn't a performer. But and Letterman drank a lot. And then I don't think it's a coincidence that he gave up drinking, you know, right before his show. And I think in a lot of ways he had like a, you know, he transferred his addiction to something to the show.
He had an addictive personality.
Exactly. You put it better. Exactly. He had addictive personality and a lot of his stories about college and before and even earlier in broadcasting are about drinking and being drunk and all this stuff. But then to kind of answer your question, you know, if you talk to everybody who worked for Letterman, you know, the one common refrain and is that, you know, he just always concluded that whatever they were doing was terrible. And it was, and he was relentless in, consistent in this belief, despite having huge amount of success. It's interesting because you watch his show and he's constantly so self-deprecating. That's so key to his persona. And you think it's kind of an act, right? But he's like that in offstage. But offstage, it's a different animal to be around that, to have that constantly. Mm-hmm. So it is an interesting question that you raised, which is like, how do you become so successful and so productive when
you're shitting on everybody? I have no boundaries, but no.
Negative. I mean, but to be fair to him, he's primarily shitting on himself. Right now, you could say that that's not, there are other people involved in it. And at some point, like, if you're always saying that I screwed up, is that another way to not take responsibility for anything? I mean, you could make also, but his first instinct is always to blame himself.
Right. But I'm going to say that I think that he is not taking responsibility for himself because he's not separating out that other people are doing this work.
Yep.
And he's blaming, this is my problem with Letterman. He's blaming them for sucking. You know, like it would be like, you know, you bring in your ads and they don't like any of the ads because they don't like any ads. So that's what I don't understand. That's what I don't see. Did he have any awareness of that? Or
he had some awareness. And I think what you described is how the people who worked for him interpreted, because you're constantly trying to make somebody happy that's an impossible task. But, you know, there's a way to look at it that it's like that. In its positive incarnation, it produces an environment of demanding high standards.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think, you know, is also what people who work for him would say, that you had to really bring your A game. And if you reject 95%, 99% of the ideas, that, you know, the cream runs to the top. They also had negative aspects of it as well, both personally and professionally. And I think if you look at sort of the decline of the show, it's inextricably tied to this quirk of his personality. I mean, the example of this that I think is really telling is Letterman hosting the Oscars,
right?
Which is in the popular imagination is this huge disaster. But, I went back and looked at it and the reviews of Letterman Oscar were mixed. The ratings were actually really good. And so I was like, well, why does everyone think that it was such a disaster, such a catastrophe? And I had a guy who does research who tracked down every joke he ever made about the Oscars.
Wow.
And, you know, if you look at like the day when he came back, he was sort of made some mild self-deprecating jokes about how he did. And then like a month later, he was sort of, you know, a little harsher. And then a year later, he's still talking about it. And he's talking about it like it was a genocide. And then 2 years later, he's still talking. 3 years later, and it was, you could really track how this myth of Letterman's catastrophic Oscar was created by himself in a way that actually really hurt his career.
Yes.
So that was I think a good example of maybe there was some short-term gain in that it was funny thing to make fun of, but it was long-term, it was self-destructive.
Right. But also what bothered me, like, especially with Meryl Marco, when you were talking, there's a great interview online. I'll post that too, that you did with Meryl Marco, blah, blah, blah. But she and a lot of other people consistently brought him great work mm-hmm. that they would have to talk him into. And that's what I don't understand. Like, how could he not see that? Like, what was that about? Can you comment on that?
That's one of the big questions that I started this book with, which is like, all right, look, here's this guy. He's a frat boy from Indiana, Midwestern. His ambition, he loved Johnny Carson, the most sort of mainstream showbiz figure. How did he become this radically experimental performer who represented for many people, including myself, sort of the quintessential New York cool? It doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up, right? So I think part of it is that it was the influence, and I tracked in the book, of people like Meryl Marco and others who talked him into ideas. But also I would say part of the reason that someone like me, who grew up, you know, in D.C. and suburban Maryland, then D.C., you know, there were certain kinds of New York cool that didn't seem accessible to me. That seemed like, oh, they seemed like, you know, the sort of East Village brand.
Like what we call hipster now?
Yeah, there was like, I not that I didn't like it. It just didn't seem like something
you didn't
that
relate
I not I just or couldn't aspire to be that, right? Letterman had a kind of New York cool that seemed reachable to me. So in a weird way, it was while obviously Meryl and these other writers were key, but the prism through which that came was also really important. Mm-hmm. That Letterman, I think, for a lot of people all over the country. Mm-hmm. Was a kind of New York cool that seemed accessible and relatable. Yeah. And that to me is a key to the success. So you needed the people, you know, like Marco, who was like, you know, a Berkeley art professor.
Brilliant.
Really encourage him to take risks. And I think, you know, the way I put it is that, like, yeah, I think intellectually Letterman wanted to be like Johnny Carson, but his instinct, mm-hmm. and this is true of people all over the place, it's like, you know, of all different, his instinct was deeply irreverent. His mm-hmm. instinct, and you see that throughout when he was in mm-hmm. radio and he was in college, the way his relationship with people, his instinct is to say, you know, fuck you to the authority, to disobey, to be difficult, for good and bad. Mm-hmm. But in his personal life, you know, like, I start the book with this scene of his first marriage.
Right.
And he is basically making a mockery of this marriage. So to him, you know, for most people, you get married, you treat it with a little bit of respect, right?
Unbelievable,
but
yes.
But he spends the whole time making fun of the whole thing and, you know, talking about,
he was drunk, right?
He was basically, I mean, he wasn't trying to restrain himself.
Right.
He was turning the whole thing. He saw the institution of marriage as a perfect target for comedy.
Right, right.
As any very self-serious institution would be.
Right.
So that is built into his DNA.
Right. So, I mean, he had gotten, and I learned all this from your book, like, he had gotten fired from, like, almost all the jobs he had until he really succeeded because, you know, he couldn't function, he was like a game show host and weather guy, and he wouldn't do it the way that they needed him to do it for the job, and then he would get fired. So he really couldn't compromise. Yes. Here's something I've been struggling with. So in the early years that I think we both like the innovative fun years. He really did. People did manage to get through to him. A few writers and Meryl like got him to do the things that wound up really being great. And then at a certain point, he wouldn't listen to anybody. And how do you think that he, like, what happened to him? What do you think happened in his head?
Right, right, right. Well, that's a great question. And I think it's like a complicated, I think the sum of it's just your classic story of fame and money insulating.
Do you think he just got overconfident?
I don't know if I would say overconfident, but I would say that there's two different schools of thought, right? Meryl's, one is that he he stopped taking risks and he, you know, felt mm-hmm. like he needed to reach a bigger audience, which he was going on 11:30, et cetera. Uh-huh. But then there's another school of thought which Marco articulated, which is that he was just evolving to be what he always wanted to be, which was a more spontaneous, improvisational performer like Carson, who wasn't messing with the form, wasn't risking. Was just kind of ad-libbing and react in the moment. And you know, they're both theories have some clout to them. Mm. I mean, one thing that I noticed that two different head writers told me, is which I think rings true to me, is that Letterman is at his best in reaction to something.
Right.
He's not a like creative. He's a creative performer in the sense that he's gonna, you know, invent something right in front of you. His creativity comes from mocking right. something else or commenting on something else. And so he needed something like a wedding to work off of, or Paul Schaefer, for his, you know, creativity to flourish.
Right. And then after a while I think he also like just couldn't stand being around, like he didn't want to deal with people as David Letterman. He became like all the remote things that he did. And then when he became famous, he didn't want to go out and do them because at that point he was David Letterman. I think that he couldn't, that affected him, his fame.
That's true. He definitely did, yeah.
Also, another thing you pointed out that I just wanted to note is that when he went from NBC to CBS, he went from like basically a theater that's as big as a high school auditorium to a 450 seat theater. And I think that had a really big effect on his performance. Do you?
Oh, totally.
And I don't think people realize that.
I in fact think that might be the most important aspect of it.
That's so interesting.
It's someone who's been in both those rooms. It's a completely different, you know, you're in like one of those studios. The studios are so much smaller than you think.
Yeah.
And they have a kind of clubhouse feel. And you know, it's like you're talking to someone with great intimacy, and which you felt watching it. It's like where, you know, the Ed Sullivan Theater is this grand high ceiling. It's actually a terrible room for comedy.
Is it? Yeah.
Yeah. I wouldn't. I think Colbert is a similar problem. That he, I think, went from a small studio to this theater. And in a lot of ways, your environment dictates your show. You have to make your performance bigger.
That's so interesting that you say that, because full disclosure, so I was on Stupid Pet Tricks in 1986, and I have to say that
the height of the show, by the way, I don't know if it's a coincidence, but the year you were on it, I argue the greatest year of Letterman.
No, I mean, I can't tell you what a big honor that was for me, and like it was a huge experience. But the thing about that I noticed when I had gone out there on the stage, I mean, this was huge for me, of course, but when I went out there on the stage, it was tiny. It was really seriously like being on stage in high school or on a high school theater or something. And that stuck with me really a lot. So I can imagine that's interesting that you also think that was a big difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean, it's just as some covering comedy and for a while now, I've become very sensitive to how a room changes the laughter, the audience, the environment. It's really radically different.
Well, I had a comedian once say that like comedians play the audience. It's like their instrument, right? Have you heard that?
Not exactly, but
who was that? I can remember. I'm going to think of his name later so I can give him a shout out, but yeah. Yeah. Also, you know what I wanted to talk about? I want to talk about David Letterman's sexuality. Oh, but before we do that, I want you just to describe a little bit of the process of putting the book together so that we all understand how much direct contact you had with Dave and stuff like that. So can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I had I started the book without a guarantee that I would talk to him, although they were very cooperative in terms of giving me information and tapes
his
and stuff.
His people,
right. So it was one of the reasons it was painful is because it's a very different book if I don't talk to him than if I do talk to him.
Sure.
But you have to kind of just, because I didn't know, I had to report all around him. And really, I think it made me work harder.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually he agreed to talk to me. And by this point, I had done so much work, it turned out to be a blessing in disguise, because by the time I had the interview, I was you know, so prepared, and I was not on a fish. I was the opposite of a fishing expedition. So I sat down and we had like, if I could do it over again, it was a 4-hour interview. He would have gone for 8 hours.
So how did that come about? Did you go to his house? Was it like up way in advance, or how did it come about?
It happened pretty quickly. It was like, I heard he would do it, and then it was at a restaurant across from Manhattan Theater Club.
Restaurant.
Yeah. It was early in the morning. I think it was before the restaurant either opened or before it got busy. But it went on so long that by the time it was like lunch hour, it was pretty busy. And it is, you know, I was very locked in, but Letterman is one of these famous people who is like kind of reclusive. So people go kind of berserk when he's in the room.
Yeah.
So there's like a tornado around him. So that I had to kind of zone that out. But,
right.
I was worried because I've read a lot of interviews where he's very prickly, but once you get him engaged, he's a spectacular interview.
Yeah. Oh, I can imagine.
Yeah. He doesn't dodge anything. I remember I spent so much of the time preparing, cutting out things that I would talk about. And if I could go back and do it again, I would prepare for an 8-hour interview instead of a 4-hour.
Wow. So when you spent time with him, did it feel like was he the person you imagined him to be, or how was that? What was his vibe like?
That's a good question. He pretty much was, you know, he was pretty cerebral and serious. So, talked to enough comedians to expect that.
Sure.
I found him very likable because he was, he was serious and smart and not on, you know, he was real. He wanted to have a conversation. Mm-hmm. And frankly, I mean, this will come off like it's boastful, but it truly is not, which is that, he was having a good time because he had been off the air for 8-9 months.
Right.
And I really think that it was like talking about his show, which is something obviously he loves and cared about, with somebody who knew it and knew his life.
Right.
In some cases, better than he did, because I was talking to people he knew back in high school and before in middle school that he wanted to know about. He was really genuinely
curious.
Oh, that's
interesting, because you had dug up his past for him.
It really was.
Hilarious. That must have been awesome. Was that an amazing? That must have been an amazing experience.
It was. I mean, it was stressful, but it's like my job is not to get him to. It's not to get these people I talk to like me. It's to get them to reveal themselves. But it helps if they like you.
Right.
Because then, as soon as I could tell that he was enjoying himself, the interview was supposed to go for an hour.
Wow.
I knew pretty early, okay, this is not going to be for...
What about his level of consciousness, emotional consciousness? Did he seem to have perspective on who he was or how he was seen or how people saw him, people at work for him, stuff like that?
Yes, but there's a limit. So if I was to argue against what I just said about him being open, right? This is what I would say. Which is that every time I asked about a thorny question, like say his affairs or something, or turning down ideas like you're talking about, or he never didn't answer. He never went off the record. Never did. His response was always to blame himself, very in the extreme, right? So he didn't justify, ratings losses or say it was the network. He didn't NBC executives, which he of course lambasted on the show. He didn't, he spent a lot of time lacerating himself over the affairs he did to his family. But it did make me wonder, right? I'm going back over the transcript. If you blame yourself for everything, is it a way, is it a way to not deal with the specifics because it's that sort of,
Yeah, I mean, it seems underneath all of that, there is some lack of consciousness. But it also seems creatively he's so driven by his instincts that he doesn't think about it that way, I guess, in a certain way. I don't know I'm not articulating that, but like he doesn't seem like the most reflective person.
No.
That's all I'm saying. to some degree he is, but not ultimately.
I think he prefers to keep it on the surface.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
that's his, and this is, we talked about this before, which is like, he's a repressed right. Midwestern guy.
Right.
And his personality, although his personality is very guarded and on the surface and polite and in the way mm-hmm. that, but, and I think one of the great accomplishments of his show, and it's one of these great ironic things, is that his persona on screen, which is highly ironic and self-deprecating, allowed him to reveal himself in a way that I don't believe he ever would right. in person. Maybe in a shrink's office he could.
Oh, but makes sense.
Through, and people who watch his show, big fans, I think, understand this. Like, you could, if you've watched him every night, you could see his mood, you could understand what he was feeling, you could. Now, it was often through him saying the opposite of what he thinks.
Right, right, right.
Even when he would come out and say, "Welcome to the extravaganza," you knew what he meant is that this is the opposite of extravaganza, right? Right? And he needed that layer of irony mm-hmm. to reveal himself through this kind of Midwestern right. repressed.
Do you have any idea where his self-loathing comes from or anything like that? It's really deep. It's really permeates him.
Yes.
That's who he is.
Yes, I think the... the standard answer would be his mom.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to put your sort of pops like that, is that his, and he said, he always says about his mom that she's not the most giving in terms of praise, right?
Right.
She's very withholding and very,
Right.
And
his father was an alcoholic, so that combo was probably, who knows what happened there. But you do give, I did get a sense of his mother, and I had, seen her on TV and stuff, but the book really does give you like kind of a sense of that, him and his mom a bit. I mean, quite a bit. So that's another reason to like read the book or audiobook it. Why I did. Okay, so I have one more question about Letterman, and then we're gonna talk about other stuff too. But there's actually a question. Okay, before we get to this last question, I wanted to ask you. So I love audiobooks, and I loved audiobooking this book. Now, uh-huh. How come you didn't read it?
They didn't ask me.
Get the fuck out.
I would have done it.
Are you kidding?
They had like all these professional audio
really?
People. Yeah, they gave me like three options.
Really?
Yes.
What did you think about that?
It's funny. Now that you mention it, I never really thought about it, but I guess I would have liked to be asked. On the other hand, I knew one person in particular who was like a professional
audiobook person.
And she recently passed away, in fact. But she was a genius at it. She was brilliant at it. She was an actress, and she prepared for these audiobooks like an actor's would for a role. Like,
right.
And in talking to her about it, I did develop a respect for that form and how it's completely its own thing that I don't have the skills or the craft to pull off. All that said, my first book, I remember the guy who did the audiobook was this guy who did like the Mets announcing, and he has that like big booming voice, and it sounds ridiculous.
Yeah. Like Bruce Springsteen's autobiography. I mean, although it's Bruce, you can't criticize it, but yeah, he's not good at it. But I'm disappointed, Jason. I'm just going to say that because I think you would have. I'm a big memoir audiobook fan because I love to hear the person who wrote it, and I'm disappointed. And you audio bowl people made a big mistake there, and you better re-record it if it's up to me. So I just wanted to ask. Let's talk about Letterman's sexuality, and then we can move on.
Okay.
So Letterman seems like a big fucking sexist dick. So he definitely seemed like a woman. Like, it's really interesting to me, and I wonder if you can put some insight on this. So what Letterman seems like to me is a real, like, he's kind of almost both extremes. Like, he presents as somebody who is just real, like, almost like a boy who doesn't even care about girls, sort of.
Right.
And then he also had a relationship with Meryl Marco, which must have been a real peer, intense relationship. But then he wound up leaving her. And then the other women he had relationships with were women that he had a lot of power over. And then at the same time in his later years, and I didn't even notice this because I wasn't watching the show then, but he turned into like a real lech. So can you What kind of dude was he? Like, was he after the chicks? Was he confident with women? Can you comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big theme of the book, of Letterman and women. I mean, it goes through the whole book. I mean, his whole career. Mm-hmm. And he has he was a serial monogamist. I mean, he would be in these long-term mm-hmm. relationships. At the same time, he always would, he would
cheat.
He would cheat. And he certainly, if you talk to people from the Comedy Store in the 70s, he was, he was a womanizer for sure. But he went from, I would say Meryl strikes, most people would say was an anomaly.
Yeah.
In the way that we're talking about how you can't write about someone's life without work, without talking about their life, or a talk show host, because they're so blurred. That was very literally true in terms of Letterman's sex life, because or romantic life, because he started the show with his longtime girlfriend, and then a woman, he cheated on her with a woman in production who he eventually married, and then he cheated on her with a woman who was started out as an intern, and then so his relationships and his work were inextricably right. combined, and there were other when the story of his blackmail and the shame came out, there were other people from work who came out or stories
right,
about.
Right.
But they were all people who were much lower status.
Yeah, so that's what's weird is like it seems like he couldn't deal with women who were his peers.
Because you figure Letterman was one of the most powerful, famous people in America. He could have been
with
Julia. Everyone thought he was with Julia Roberts or he was with some student. But it was
he could have dated a babe, but he couldn't handle it because he really didn't like himself. That's what it comes. That's I'm just going to just simplify that down to like one sentence. So I'm going to do remind people again that they're listening to the greatest station in the entire world. And it's radiofreebrooklyn.org. And I'm Dr. Lisa from Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit every Thursday, 2 to 3. And I'm here with the one and literally only one and only New York Times comedy critic, Jason Zineman. We've been talking about his book that he wrote about Letterman, which you should get from Amazon, Letterman, the Last Giant of Late Night. And now we're going to, so go and download our apps because then you can take Radio Free Brooklyn with you everywhere. And we have like such a great variety of shows. It's like having your best friend in your pocket. That's my line. RadioFreeBrooklyn.org/iPhone or RadioFreeBrooklyn.org/Android. So let's talk about Jason Zineman, the comedy critic. So what's it like, first of all, I want to tell you my impression of Jason, folks.
Oh, no, okay. I'm excited to hear this. Okay.
Person, Jason is, I'm a lot more comfortable with Jason than I expected to be. He's very like normal, down to earth, not full of himself. Okay. So I'll put it to you that way. But he also seems like just really conventional to me. I'm not saying I don't know him, but he's got like a nice shirt. He's got that like, he's just like a regular nice guy. He's married to like a major lawyer and he's got two kids. And of course, they live in Park Slope and now they're thinking of moving to Prospect. Whatever they need. Like your kids go to private schools.
No.
Good for you. So you seem really.
You're making me sound very boring.
You haven't bored me yet.
I'll take boring. I'll take it. I'm not complaining.
No, but you know what? You just seem really, really normal. Yeah. I mean, when you think of comedians, the comedians are freaks. And you seem just really normal and like stable and all that. And so what's it like being involved in the comedy world? Has being writing and being that involved in comedy affected you, affected your view of the world, affected your view of your own work? And also, you have a theater background. You're not like a comedy, and you've written a book on science fiction and stuff. You're not like a gung-ho comedy person, even though like you're great at writing about it. So go. Yeah. So yes. Tell us about that.
I mean, it's been a pretty, I mean, it's the covering comedy is the happiest I've been in my career. And it's really been a fascinating world to dig into. And I think part of that is that it's the sort of this new area, and so there's a lot of freedom. But I think to your question, I guess, is that I've never thought of myself, even though like I grew up in my, you know, around the theater. My mom ran a theater, and I covered theater, and now I cover comedy. I've never thought of myself. I've sort of aggressively not thought of myself as like part of the theater world or part of the comedy world. Like, you know, there's a lot of people, theater critics, who will refer to themselves as part of the theater community, and theater people do. They'll say, "Oh, now you're in the theater community," and I'm always like, "No. I'm not part of the theater community. I'm not." Even though you know, that's a little bit of a, you know, pedantic point. Mm-hmm. I think of myself as a journalist first, and the kind of journalist. And with all that comes from that. If I'm really investigate, like, you're, it's great to hear somebody say like what you look like and what you sound like. Seriously, because it's important. You know how you come off is important. Right. And I think, you know, you could be a good journalist in all different kinds of ways, and you can have all different kinds of personas can be effective.
Of course.
A kid in summers, I worked in sales, which I often talk about as like I sold some theater subscriptions over the phone. And in a lot of ways, I think that was the best education I had in terms of being a journalist, because you've got to learn how to talk to different kinds of people.
Right.
And all of this is to say that like I find it effective to be not have like a really. I think a good journalist is really curious and is open to wildly different kinds of things, and can make people feel comfortable because you know, you can adapt and be different to different things. That's not to say I'm lying. I am conventional. I do live in Park Slope and I have two kids. And I'm there's 100% true, guilty as charged. But it also happens that I don't think it would be effective as like interviewing comedians. If I was like playing the funny guy, I'd make a big attempt to not try to be funny or pretend that I'm funny. One, because I think it will backfire. Two, I don't think that's my job. And and as it happens, most comedians aren't like that anyways. So but I do think that like the most interesting thing in the, like what you're doing right now, interviewing. Is the hardest part of my job. And the most interesting part of my job. Like that's the part that I think the most about. That sit like in the same room with somebody and get them to reveal themselves, right? And sometimes talking a lot can do the trick. Like being vulnerable and revealing something about yourself or something that's weird about yourself can help somebody else open up. But I find more often than not where I fail is when I don't know to stop talking. I don't know when to listen. Like listening is such an important underrated skill.
Yeah.
And when I listen to myself doing interviews, the parts when I'm always angry at myself are when I'm like, oh, just shut up. Just listen harder. There's like various degrees of listening. So you know, I have always been a critic and a reporter. I think one helps the other. And my, in terms of reporting, you know, there's nothing makes me happier. I mean, I just I've done a couple reporting reporting trips recently. Then like going into a new world where I know nothing about and just listening to people talk and trying to understand. I was just in Las Vegas, right? They have a very different style than New York comedy. These like Las Vegas. And, you know, I talk to all these comedy club owners over there and it's just people, in my opinion, like there's nothing more fascinating than people, just ordinary people. They're endlessly fascinating. And people love to talk. They love to talk and you don't have to work that hard. You just have to
get them going.
Exactly. Listen to me. I like to talk. Right?
I mean, that's what we do. Yeah. So, but like also, I mean, you're not a cool dude. Like, you know, and I imagine like what happens with comedians? Like, do they trust you? What if they're all in the green room, like snorting coke and you're there? Do you see that kind of stuff?
I mean, I haven't seen anyone snorting coke, but I think it's really a good thing for me to be seen as It's funny. I've never thought about this. So this is the first time I've ever articulated it. But I'm so comfortable being seen as not cool.
Yeah.
I think that is much better than trying to seem cool.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, one thing, it's funny. I'll illustrate it. When I was a telemarketer, was 16 years old, my persona was a little bit weird. I had this theory that people are so skeptical of salesmen, particularly telemarketers,
right,
that if you did what other people in the room were doing, which is like act like your little brother or like the kindly old aunt, people see right through that.
Right.
So what I would do is my persona was as like a pathological lying shyster. So I'd be like, is Miss Levy there? Yes, it's Miss Levy. Miss Levy, this is your lucky day. Like, you might say, how could I get 5 plays for only $95? Well, I'll tell you. And so by doing that, by presenting myself as a buffoon, essentially, people thought, oh, this guy is an idiot. He's like, I feel superior to him.
Ah. Right?
And, he's harmless. He's kind of funny to laugh at, right? And then they start talking. And once they start talking, you have them.
Right.
And it's not that different in that if you're, if you try too hard, if you let them see you as just like kind of, someone who's not, as a journalist sitting there and not trying to be their friend,
mm-hmm.
I find that you can get them to be more comfortable and open up.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have, it's as I said, like with Letterman, it helped that he liked me. But it's not always the case. Oftentimes I find like that you don't need to get someone to love you or to feel like they're exactly like you. Sometimes it helps, but not always.
Right. But they know like you're not trying to be like, because a lot of people in your situation would want to be one of them or hang out with the comics. They know you're not, you don't play that role.
I think they're more, I mean, look, I come in with a lot of advantages, like the New York Times.
Yeah, right. Big, your press pass.
Exactly. Like, if anything, the New York Times reputation is not cool, right?
So
the New York Times, to the extent that the New York Times is a hugely valuable thing that I'm associated with in terms of getting access and people.
Right.
Like, if I'm trying to play up the New York Times, it doesn't help for me to be like, hey, you want to do some coke? Like, better for me to be like the most New York Times version of myself that I can, because they're more impressed by that than whatever I could pull off.
Right. So how is it like your wife? So your wife is a lawyer and she's like incredibly successful. She's like a Harvard Yale lawyer. That's so crazy. What is she doing with you?
It's a good question. She's punching down, as they say.
No, but how does your family, and you have two kids, and I picture like your life being fairly stable and normal and pleasant, actually. And, like your house is probably like, you probably have like, you don't run out of toilet paper, things like that. Your kids are fed. They go to bed on time, that kind of stuff. So how do you square, like, how is the life of, like, your job and all that other stuff? How does your wife look at it? What do your kids think about it? Do you ever take them? Tell us about that.
My kids, I don't know. It's interesting. I've tried, I've done some stories where my kids are involved, like taking them to shows and
stuff. And they are how old? And
4 and 9.
Boy, girl.
Two girls. I don't know. I do think that like stability, I think in, people don't think of like being a critic as being someone who has to like, people understand that artists have to take risks.
Right.
But journalists also have to take risks.
Right.
And there's different kinds of risks you have to take, but they're, it's a public job. You take a lot of criticism. If you just do the expected thing, you're not going to be as successful and you're not going to do as good a job. And I do think that, certainly I was raised with a very confident mother, Jewish mother, who is an artist who I think I got a lot of confidence from. But then also having like a stable personal life enables me to, I think,
take more risks
in my professional
life. Guys, see, that's what I'm saying. Get out of the basement and put those marijuana pipes away.
No, I'm saying? I'm not trying to say don't smoke marijuana. I know that.
Well, it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. That's why I said that.
That's just me.
No, but I do think stability, I value stability a lot because I'm not someone who's just innately that stable. And I have gotten my stability. It's hard won, and I think that it's really valuable, and a lot of people don't appreciate it enough, and I think it can really make your work more creative and better.
Where I'm not with the flip side of having a successful lawyer wife who works a lot is that, you know, she's like always working, so I like to have two kids, I've found, you know, I have to do more childcare.
Right.
And that is a new thing. Like, I'm writing a book with having to look after kids is much harder than writing a book without one.
Right. And I'm sure.
And I've done both. And I would say, you know, like having kids definitely changes my perspective on this stuff much more than getting married.
Really? How come?
Like, I worry that I get, if I'm really honest, I worry that I get worse at my job because of kids. I worry that I think having a stable life can make you take more risks, but sometimes I worry that having kids does make you more cautious and more conservative and more sentimental, which is, like, I'm very sensitive to now seeing what works of art work on me in ways that wouldn't have before, and it pisses me off. Like, it doesn't, like, that bothers me sometimes.
What do you mean?
Like, I am such a, like, any work of art which involves, like, you know, father-daughter stuff, I'm like, bawling. I just watched this terrible Adam Sandler Netflix movie that just came out, like a Father of the Bride kind of thing. And, like, it's a bad movie, but I'm like, it's working, it's manipulating me, and I'm much more susceptible to that. And that is not a... I don't like that about
I was just thinking, I wonder how your wife explains what you do at her job. How do you think what do you think she says?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think the truth is lawyers are, and I can say this without any fear because they all know it, they're deeply boring.
They think that about themselves.
Yes, they do. They think that they're very,
I didn't know that.
So anyone who's doing anything like writing or creative, whatever, is like the most, they're very interested in it.
That's good.
So that is, you know, and I think it's interesting. Theater is a much more rarefied, I used to cover theater.
Right.
So people might or may not go to the theater, but everyone kind of knows a little bit about comedy. Like, they have opinions on it.
Yeah.
Or they think they know that.
Yeah.
So it's like saying you cover comedy, suddenly everyone's like, what do you think of Amy Schumer? What do you think of Jerry Seinfeld? Whatever. It's like sports, you know, for certain people. You know,
right. So it hasn't hurt the fact, so it hasn't hurt your cocktail party invitations. you probably get invited to too many with lawyers, but or whatever.
I do. I will say that. I get invited to too
many. Are they social?
Lawyers.
Yeah, they want you at... They're like, it's probably helping your wife. It's like, well, if you bring Jason, you know, make sure you bring Jason. They're probably all saying that. But what about the hours? That's really kind of part of it too. Like comedy. See, this is what I don't personally like about comedy is the late nights.
Yes. No, that I had gotten used to like the 8 o'clock curtains of theater, and comedy, it could be like 10 o'clock, 9 o'clock, midnight.
So what? How do you do that? You just bring your kids in their pajamas and stuff? Or how do you do it?
It actually is works well because my wife comes home late. So too late for me to make a Broadway show. But sometimes late enough that I can then go out to see like a 10 o'clock comedy show. So actually these weird and late nights work.
You guys worked it out. That's good. Do you form relationships with comedians, or do you kind of feel like that's not part of your job? They're like, that's a different, you don't want to like get too chummy.
I mean, I definitely try to maintain a certain distance. And I think it's important. At the same time, you know, I'm a reporter, so I have all they, I and they all, you know,
yeah,
you get
they
to know
you.
Them.
Yeah.
And after years of, you know, it's a very unique thing. I've been doing this long enough that I've written about people when they were unknown,
right.
And now they're stars, and they have a, you have a particular relationship with somebody who you've wrote about you early.
Yeah.
And so,
right.
So I have a lot of, at this point, a lot of sources, and yeah, the but it's a balancing act, because I don't want to get too close, in which case I can't write about them.
Right. Okay, we're gonna have to go soon. I had a couple of like just like dumb personal questions that I just want to know because you're here and I want to get to ask you.
Yeah.
So anyway, here's something I'm really curious about: comedy in New York versus comedy in L.A. And personally, I'm really mad that all the comedy people I knew moved to L.A. So tell me about that. Help
that
me rationalize.
That makes me mad too. That makes no. I can't. I hate it too. It happens all the time.
So what do you think is the difference, or what's better, what's worse? What would you do if you were a stand-up comic?
I'm a New York partisan, you know.
So yeah.
I think the cliche is that like New York is a little more aggressive, more joke heavy. LA is more alt and is more wandering. At the same time, the reason New York's better is because there's more places to perform here. So if you want to get really good, if you want to work a lot, it's much mm-hmm. easier to do that here mm-hmm. than it is in LA. But LA, because it's so expensive here and you could actually live like a mm-hmm. normal life without being a huge blockbuster success in LA, they are here for a couple of years and they go to LA and we keep losing a lot of talent, but then a lot of them come back.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the truth is I try to go to LA a couple times a year and the difference has shrunk. It's actually more I mean, you could go into it, but pretty much it's like there's so many New York comics there and so many LA comics.
So is one city more active than the other, or are they about the same?
I think there's more performances per night in New York for sure.
But there's
maybe there might be more. I think there are more comedians in LA because there's more jobs out there,
so it's more, well, who knows. So here's one more question. Do you have any interest? This is for my art people. Do you have any interest in contemporary art or performance art?
I'm fascinated by performance art.
And is there any performance art that you like? Do you know, do you have an opinion on Marina Abramović?
Oh, man.
You hate her?
No, I don't hate her.
I do.
You do?
Well, I do now.
I want to hear your opinion on her.
No, I don't. I've made fun of her.
I mean,
I used to really, really like her. And then once she got really commercial when she did her MoMA show.
Was that the turning point, the MoMA show?
Yeah. So, but she's done a lot of innovation. She's a really egomaniac. And she has taken advantage of artists. She has a bad rap. Do you know who Narcissa is?
No, who's that?
That's somebody. We got to talk about that later because we're not going to have time. But Narcissa, to me, is like a god right now.
Interesting.
Yeah, a really, really talented performer, visual artist.
Where does she perform?
She does some kind of like, she performs at the Box a lot, I think.
Okay.
You look her up. Look
All right.
her up.
I will.
Look
I will.
Her up. We've got like a minute and a half left. So I just... You know what I want to do?
Yes.
I want to give a big shout out to my good friend Alain Danziger, because his show is on right after this one. And this is a big thing here at Radio Free Brooklyn. We support each other. We want you to stay with us, because the minute this show is done, you can listen to Alain do Lost and Rewound. He's really, really a fun guy. He's doing really well. He's a director. He's directing this big show now. And just a great show with talking. And he plays tapes from like the 90s and stuff like that. So I want to make sure that you guys stick around. And okay, maybe one more question. Why is Amy Schumer so controversial? We'll see if we can fit this in 1 minute.
I can't do that in an hour. I think it's mystifying. I think she's one person who I've been following since I was the first person to write about her when no one knew who she was. And all I'll say is that like I'm a connoisseur of like critiques. She's been slammed from the beginning. But nobody has taken more criticism than her. And it is not that she doesn't deserve some of it, because, of course, she's in the public and she's, flawed. But it's an interesting story how polarizing she is.
Yeah.
And time is up, but I will write about